The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
And we're seeing the kind of the next wave of that in the response to the Snowden revelations, because a bunch of our countrymen, and again, not the wing nuts, a lot of people in the center, a lot of very thoughtful members of our body politic are saying, all right, the president, the Congress, and the courts are on board, but that doesn't constitute consent of the governed anymore. That's consent of the governors. You told them, but you didn't tell me. And fundamentally, I think that's the crisis in oversight.
I'm Cody Poplin, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, January 31st, 2015. That was General Michael Hayden you just heard, former director of both the Central Intelligence Agency and the National Security Agency. Last weekend, General Hayden delivered the keynote address at Washington and Lee School of Law, which hosted a symposium on cyber surveillance in the post-Snowden age. During his address, General Hayden outlined an unapologetic defense of the NSA's recently revealed activities, yet remained candid about where the agency has made mistakes and where it can improve. In particular, the speech raises a profound question. Can intelligence agencies succeed in a society that demands greater and greater transparency about those activities? It's the Lawfare Podcast, episode number 108, General Michael Hayden on cybersecurity and the post-Snowden age.
Thanks for the opportunity to come chat. I'm going to try to commit some interesting things up here in the next 30 minutes. And I think, Margaret, the agenda has an opportunity to ask some questions before we're done. Okay, good. Great. This is a fascinating topic for me because I kind of lived it. And I'm also a citizen of this great republic. And what we're talking about here this weekend are fundamental issues that we've had in front of us since our colonial days. And I guess one of the things I appreciated out of the first two sessions is, you know, we did not characterize this, as some do, as kind of a combat between the forces of light and the forces of darkness. You know, none of us have seen a necessity to demonize the other side. As I said, this has been a constant discussion for all free peoples, but it's been highlighted for these free peoples here in the United States. I was up in British Columbia a couple of years ago, and it was the Provincial Convention on Privacy, and they had the former director of America's National Security Agency there, kind of an unnatural act. And I defined privacy this way. I said, privacy is the line we continuously negotiate between ourselves as unique creatures of God and ourselves as social animals. And then in the first category, we have a right to keep things to ourselves. And in the second category, we have a responsibility to reveal things about ourselves to the larger community for the greater good. And frankly, you know, you pick up the texts of Madison and Hamilton and Adams and Jefferson, you get the same kind of debate. Where should that line be drawn? This past summer, I was out at a place called The Grove for it's actually a long-term camping thing for rich white guys, okay? And I was the middle weekend lakeside speaker, which apparently is a really primo spot. And I said to them, you know, we've kind of tacked back and forth on this, you know, back revolutionary period. You and I thought the king had too much power. I've got a lot of British friends. There are a range of views on that. Okay? But you and I thought King George had too much power. And then we win the war and we create the Articles of Confederation. And after a very short period of time, we decide we've not given the government enough power. And so a bunch of folks, many from around here, go up to Philadelphia in 1789 and create a much stronger centralized government. But then a whole bunch of the other folks who were involved in the revolution thing don't accept the 1789 thing until you give me a Bill of Rights that lists the limitations. I mean, did you see how this keeps going back and forth? I mean, for our purposes, it's about unreasonable search and seizure. What constitutes reasonableness when it comes to the sovereign authority gathering data or information or things from the citizens of the republic that form us? And we go back and forth even today. I was struck was the word I was going to use, but I think the right word is stunned. After the Boston Marathon thing, and we later learned that the Tsarnaevi were surfing jihadist websites, and you know, a significant fraction of our population, and you know, and not all of them wearing tinfoil on their heads, a significant fraction of our population says, why weren't you tracking those guys on the web? As if it was a good idea for the nation's security services to be aware of what permanent legal residents and United States citizens were actually doing when they were doing web surfing. So we kind of go back and forth. How we decide that you know, what constitutes reasonableness is actually a product of the totality of circumstances in which we find ourselves in history. In other words, I know this is fact. What I viewed as reasonableness on the morning of September 10th, I viewed in a very different light on the afternoon of September 11th at the National Security Agency, and I actually started to do different things. And I didn't need to ask Mother May I from the Congress or the President or anyone else. It was within my charter, but in terms of the mature judgment of what's reasonable and what's not reasonable, okay, the death of 3,000 countrymen kind of tilted me in a direction over here, perfectly within my authorities, but a different place than the one in which I was located before the attacks take place. So if we're going to draw this line, I think we have to understand that it's kind of a movable feast here. It moves back based upon, I mean this seriously, the totality of circumstances. But that's really hard to decide. And it's really hard to decide now. Let me just kind of list the reasons why this has been so damnably difficult for us. Number one is secrecy. I get it. I know more about this than many people in the room. And I'm actually quite comfortable with it. And my belief is you'd be more comfortable with it, too, if I could tell you more stuff. So why can't I tell you more stuff? And the answer to that question is, if I tell you more stuff, then my stuff isn't worth doing in the first place. In other words, I haven't figured out a way to whisper in the ear of 350 million of my countrymen what it is we're doing without tipping our hand to those against whom we're doing this in the first place. So secrecy, it gets in the way, and it will permanently get in the way. It gets too much in the way right now. I think we can do better at this, but it will always be an issue. The fact-based discussion right now is also suffering from the fact that it's not happening in isolation. Mike Rogers, now a radio commentator, but prior to that, chairman of the House Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence, Chairman Rogers used to describe this Snowden thing, the 215-702 stuff, happening inside a larger perfect storm. And he just kind of rattles off, you know, what is or is not going on at the IRS, okay? What it does or doesn't mean when the president claims the right to determine when Congress is or is not in recess, so he can make recess appointments. The whole question of the EPA passing environmental regulations inconsistent with the will of Congress expressed in what laws Congress decided not to support. And then finally, a campaign run on the slogan, "We can't wait." I don't mean to be political here. I don't mean that at all. But we have seen recently, and not just in the last 6 years, we have seen an accrual of executive power. And there's been a pushback against that executive power. And this whole NSA thing is nested right in the middle of that broader societal question. It makes it much harder to isolate and discuss the NSA thing just on its own merits. This whole debate, you know, this fact-based discussion, what constitutes reasonableness, I frankly think has been badly harmed by the way the Snowden stuff has been rolled out. And we already heard today that, you know, Glenn Greenwald did his own picking and choosing in terms of what are the Snowden revelations he would make public, in what parts of specific documents he would push out there. I debated Greenwald in Toronto back in May. It was Mike Hayden and Alan Dershowitz on one side. Who would have thought that? Okay. And Glenn Greenwald and the young fellow who started Reddit on the other. It was like hockey night in Canada without a puck. Greenwald was fond of saying, and Poitras, Laura Poitras, fond of accusing NSA of suspicionless surveillance. And let me just reflect on that just for a second. That's almost a nonsense comment for somebody with my background. I'm not a law enforcement officer. I don't suspect anybody. I am simply going out there to retrieve information that helps keep my countrymen free and safe. This is not about guilt. In fact, let me be really clear, okay? NSA doesn't just listen to bad people. NSA listens to interesting people. People who are communicating information. The information is what we're pursuing. Information to keep you safe and free. I got a travel agent in location A talking to a travel agent in location B about the travel of terrorist C. I'm jumping on the comm. I'm intercepting the communication between these two innocents because that information that they're communicating is useful to keeping you free and safe. Greenwald, Poitras, and others have used the language of law enforcement and justice in order to describe and criticize foreign intelligence collection. And this may intrigue you enough to ask a question or two about it in the Q&A period. I don't care. Let me put you in another lane here and just give you a sense of this, all right? People come to me and say, do you think people at Guantanamo should be tried in military commissions or in Article III courts? And my answer is, I don't give a damn. Just give me a chance to talk to him first. I am not a law enforcement agency. I've never been part of law enforcement. I'm part of foreign intelligence. That operates under different rules. So that's Greenwald and Poitras, very agendaed. Someone mentioned today that Greenwald self-described as an advocacy journalist. There's some good journalists out there rolling up Snowden stuff. Bart Gellman from the Washington Post, there's another. Bart actually calls NSA, Greenwald and Poitras don't. But Bart will say, I got this, talk to me, tell me, you know, kind of stop me before I kill again. let me know if this is really, if I don't recognize how much harm to security this is going to do, which that, frankly, is a very responsible step on his part. But even Bart gets it wrong. I mean, let me kind of roll this out, because it's an important point. Snowden certainly stimulated a necessary debate, a point made 3 or 4 times in the last 2 panels. But he also distorted a necessary debate. Let me do this conversation, this rollout that Bart Gellman had. August 15th, a couple years ago, Bart had a front page, above the fold story in the Washington Post. Bold headline, NSA violates privacy thousands of times per year. Okay. So I did a little research. I actually wrote a kind of a counter-op-ed, which I'm going to get to the fine print about in a minute. But let me tell you what I said about Bart's. And it, by the way, Bart and I have been on debating stages down at Duke, up at American University a couple of times. So we know each other really well. I pointed out that the violations that Gelman pointed out were all the incidents were inadvertent. No one claimed that any rules were intentionally violated. All the incidents were discovered, reported, and corrected by NSA itself. Thousands of violations per year, right? Fully two-thirds of the violations were comprised of what NSA calls roamers. These are legitimately targeted foreigners who were temporarily in the United States and thus temporarily treated as U.S. persons, protected by the Fourth Amendment. So picture a cell phone call, not collected in the air here, all right, but made by one of these individuals who were legitimately targeting overseas. But he's now in the United States, and that cell phone call is routed back to pick your place, Portugal, Norway, Pakistan. And it's routed back there because Norway, Portugal, or Pakistan wants to bill them. Right? So it goes back through the switch there so they can actually tack the fee on. And then that call comes back across the Atlantic with the call number identifier being the foreign number, coming across the Atlantic back to the United States, looking every inch like a foreign-based call to the National Security Agency. There's nothing in the call's content or the physics of the intercept that it's being made here until, of course, the content of the call reveals something like, I'm down here in Battery Park, the view over to Governor's Island is spectacular, and I'm going to eat dinner uptown tonight, at which point NSA discovers, oh, expletive, this foreign target is now in the United States, and the inadvertent collection has to stop. Two-thirds of the privacy violations that Bart said took place were roamers. Other violations included database queries. That means searches of data already collected. The document that that Bart relied on was an internal NSA document, reveals that in one quarter, there were 115 incidents of queries that were incorrectly entered, mistyping, transposed numbers, using too broad search terms, and so on. 115 incidents that were part of his thousands of incidents per year. That's 115 out of 61 million that quarter. So let me give you an alternative headline for Bart's piece. Yeah. NSA violated privacy thousands of times. How about this headline? NSA damn near perfect. An additional reason why this debate has become more difficult than it should have been, and I freely admit this, is that our government has been absolutely flat-footed in responding to the kinds of things that have been put out there. I mentioned this Bart Gelman thing in the Washington Post on August 15th. So August 16th, the day after it, USA Today calls the National Security Agency, says, we're going to run a he said, she said on Monday on our editorial page. We're writing the he said about how bad this is. And NSA, you know, we want to be kind of fair here. So NSA, why don't you write the she said? And this is beyond my view. I do not know this is going on. About 11 o'clock Saturday night, I get a phone call from a young woman named Katie Montgomery, who runs the public affairs branch of the Chertoff Group. It says, we just got a call from USA Today. They want you to write the she said for the he said, or the, and so on and so forth. I go, Katie, it's 11 o'clock Saturday night. No. But then Katie tells me the rest of the story. NSA took on the responsibility to write the she said. NSA crafted the she said. NSA, quote, cannot get their response cleared through the interagency, unquote. That's French. Let me translate the French for you. The White House won't let them do it. So I said to Katie, all right, okay, fine, I'll do it. So I got up the next morning, made my wife a coffee, took it up, a little espresso, Nespresso machine there, really good, up there. Got her up about 30 minutes early for church, and I sat down on my kitchen counter with my kitchen laptop, and I wrote 600 words of English prose, pushing back on the Gelman article. This is too self-referential, I'm begging forgiveness now, all right? It's the only way I can tell the story. I wrote 600 words of English prose 10 years out of the National Security Agency, pushing back on the Gelman article. I've got to send it to CIA to get cleared for security. They cleared about 2 o'clock in the afternoon on Sunday, which is very generous because they don't only work on Sunday. I toss it to USA Today about 2:30. About 4 o'clock, USA Today op-ed page editor calls me back. She says, we want to really thank you. We just don't want it to be he said. We want it he said, she said. This is really, really well crafted. Thank you very much. I hope you don't mind. We changed a fair amount of our he said based upon your she said. I already told you, it's too self-referential, okay? I'm sorry. But the point I'm trying to suggest to you is this isn't that hard. And we did a horrible job trying to explain what it was we were doing to the broader American public. We let the story get way out from underneath us. I mean, I sat there on Fox News Sunday with Justin Amash, the Republican Tea Party guy from Grand Rapids. I mean, it's like we were living in alternative universes in terms of his description of what NSA was doing and my knowledge of what NSA actually does. I guess there's one other reason why the government's response to this was horribly flat-footed, and it really came out today. Stephen mentioned it a couple of times. So, but let me kind of play it back for you. Out of the Grand Compromise of the 1970s, which, as Stephen suggested to you, was a really unusual thing. I mean, in practically every other Western democracy, intelligence collection is the province of the executive. But coming out of Church Pike and all of that kerfluffle, it was decided in our democracy that we were going to share governance. We were going to share oversight of intelligence collection with the other branches of government. So what you get are the House and Senate Permanent Select Committees on Intelligence, and you get the FISA Court. Right? A reason I think the government, NSA's response, let me narrow it down. A reason NSA was so slow out of the gate and trying to explain itself was NSA thought they were cool. NSA thought they were good to go. Because this program had been authorized by the president, had been approved by Congress, was overseen by both the HPSI and the CISI. And by the way, did you notice who the strongest supporters of these programs were? It was the chair and ranking member of the two intelligence committees. So, approved by the president, authorized by the Congress, by bipartisan majorities multiple times, and overseen by the federal court system and the FISA court. Executive, legislative, judicial, Church Pike, Grand Compromise. Jack. This is a Madisonian trifecta. They had it all. And it wasn't enough. Now, the discussion today in the panel was that it wasn't enough because the oversight mechanism was broken. I'm not so sure. Again, back to my point. Feinstein, Chambliss, Rupesberger, Rogers, the oversight chair and ranking were the strongest supporters of the program. They knew the program. I don't know. Look, I'm willing to entertain the arguments, all right? But I'm not so sure the cause of this issue, the high fever, came out of the judgment that the oversight process was broken. I think it came out of something different. I think it came out of a fundamental cultural change. Back at CIA, way pre-Snowden, this is 07, maybe early 08, I've got a civilian advisory board, kind of like folks like many people here in the room. When we ask to come in, they're very generous. We usually keep their names private. I've got permission to reveal one name to you, Carly Fiorina. Carly was on the advisory board. I gave the advisory board tough questions like, how come I'm paying so much for my IT? Or how can I recruit to not only look like America, but to look like America's enemies? The question I gave Carly, however, was much more difficult than the other two. The question I gave to Carly was this. Carly, I've been thinking. Is America going to be able to conduct espionage in the future? Espionage, an activity that requires secrecy for success. Is America going to be able to conduct espionage in the future? Inside a broader political culture that every day demands more transparency and more public accountability for every aspect of national life. And Carly took her team and went off to the mountaintop and talked to folks like ourselves, came back 3 or 4 months later, said, Mike, we got an answer. Okay, great. I walked across the hall in the 7th deck of CIA, sat down in the conference room and said, okay, Carly, will America be able to conduct espionage inside a broader political culture that every day demands more transparency and more public accountability from every aspect of national life? And Carly looked me right in the eye and said, not clear. Which is actually a very, very powerful answer. And we're seeing the kind of the next wave of that in the response to the Snowden revelations, because a bunch of our countrymen, and again, not the wing nuts, a lot of people in the center, a lot of very thoughtful members of our body politic are saying, all right, the president, the Congress, and the courts are on board, but that doesn't constitute consent of the governed anymore. That's consent of the governors. You told them, but you didn't tell me. And fundamentally, I think that's the crisis in oversight. Not whether or not Mike Rogers passed on Jim Clapper's letter in 2011 that said, hey, you know, we're collecting all your metadata, right? Which, by the way, Jim wrote, and Mike did not pass on to all the other members of Congress. So this is a tough issue. By the way, if we hack our way through all this underbrush, all right, and we kind of get to the facts of the case, okay, we actually have a really true sight picture, that also may not be good enough. I said this at the Oxford Union almost a year ago today. Right? I said to the British students gathered there that, you know, you're all coming into the movie late in the third reel, and you're looking at what's on the screen, and you're convinced the butler did it. But, you know, you might want to stay for the second showing. Or maybe because the DVR kind of hit the thing and run it back. And watch the movie from the beginning. Because what it is you're seeing may not have the same meaning you think it has. Because you've come in on the last act. I'll be very brief about this because I won't leave time for questions. But let me hit 2 or 3 points. Okay? For most of the life of NSA, y'all were pretty enthusiastic about our intercepting the communications of the Soviet Union. Okay? And one of our targets in the Soviet Union was SRF, Soviet Strategic Rocket Forces, guys with the ICBMs. And they used to transmit their orders out of SRF headquarters in Moscow through microwave shots up over the Urals to Soviet ICBM fields in the Far East, out on the steppes. And we were all over that network. We were intercepting communications 24 hours a day, looking for words of interest, like launch. There isn't a civil libertarian alive who gave a damn about that. The 21st century equivalent of those Soviet SRF signals on that isolated microwave network jumping over the Ural Mountains, our proliferator, drug trafficker, terrorist communications, pretty much existing in emails, in a global integrated telecommunications grid, coexisting with your Gmail and your Hotmail. And so the fundament I want to give you here is, if you want these guys to do what they did for you in the 70s and 80s, they got to be on networks where your stuff is. And that's just the way it is. A second reality. Now, this hit me when I became director of NSA in 99. We were being overwhelmed by data. Just think of your own community. You know, look, hey, all you college students, you don't remember this, but the other folks remember this. Remember your communications patterns 25 years ago? Remember you used to have to wait till 6 o'clock on a Sunday night to make that call? Yeah? None of your students understand that. Okay, but we did, because communications were sparse and expensive. And now you know they're not. And NSA was being overwhelmed by the volume, variety, and velocity of global communications. And we were sitting there kind of on the beach, kind of doing the Heisman thing, all right, trying to stop this tsunami of communications coming at us. And we decided, about 99, way pre-Snowden, way pre-9/11, about 99 is, we ain't stopping that wave. That wave is going to overwhelm us. I have an idea. Turn around and swim with it. Turn around and use volume for your advantage. The word for that is bulk collection. And then applying metadata analysis to the bulk collection. Pre-9/11. What I'm trying to suggest to you is the things that Snowden revealed were not things kind of sitting in the lower right-hand desk drawer out at NSA headquarters. You know, with the NSA director just waiting for the opportunity to be able to pull them out and spring them on you. Kind of like Mr. Burns in one of The Simpsons. Excellent. We can do metadata. It was a logical response to a technological demand in order to continue to do what the agency has historically done. And then third reality, besides commingling of communications in bulk, was simply the erosion of the concept of geography. Right? We used to think that there was a clear distinction between foreign and domestic intelligence and law enforcement. So 19 guys living in America killed 3,000 of us. And so there was a question about the enemy is inside the gates. And all your talk today about 215? 215 is such a safe haven. 215 is legislated by Congress. I was doing metadata collection under the president's raw Article 2 authorities from October 7th, 2001 forward. The 215 program doesn't begin with the Patriot Act. It begins with the private order I got from President Bush. And we decided it was lawful and consistent with the president's authorities as commander-in-chief because the enemy was inside the gate and we knew of no other way to identify that enemy that had less of an impact on your privacy than collecting metadata, but addressing it only under very limited circumstances. And by the way, when the enemy wasn't inside the gate, 215, his emails were 702. Look, there is nothing American about a communication, an email communication on Gmail between a bad man in Pakistan and a bad man in Yemen that is sitting on a server in Redmond, Washington. There is nothing American about it other than it's sitting on a server in Redmond, Washington. And that's the 702 program. Now, I told the folks at Oxford, and I'll repeat to you here, after I've now all explained this, it is a reasonable conclusion on any of your parts to simply say, I got it, Hayden, I understand why you do it. I hate it. Don't do it anymore. I got it. But let's start with why that was done and what the costs were in not doing it. I love the last panel and Ashley talking about the international dimension of this. I actually didn't have it in the talk, but I just, here it comes. So, almost a year ago now, in addition to the trip to Oxford, I'm in Munich for the Munich Security Conference. And I mean, the Germans are in high dudgeon about this, or this whole Snowden thing, all right? So I am an official panelist at the Munich Security Conference at the Hotel Bayerischof in downtown Munich. Pay no attention to the fact that the panel started at 10:30 at night and was in the bar of the hotel. It was on the agenda. And I'm there with Jane Harman, a German-American telecommunications executive, August Honning, who was my counterpart in BND. August is now retired. And then the fair and balanced moderator was from Der Spiegel. Okay. And so we're going through the what are you Americans doing? So the fairly early in the conversation, the question of the chancellor's cell phone became a topic of conversation. So we're talking about I'm not admitting anything, all right? You know, if these stories are true, whatever. So It's in the dark. I mean, we're literally up on the stage in the bar, the nightclub stage of the bar, and it's dark out there. It's 10:30, pushing 11. People are swallowing pills, eating pommes frites. It's a really loose crowd. And I hear this German-accented voice in English say to me, "Well, I guess I should aspire to be chancellor, and therefore you Americans will not listen to me." And I couldn't resist responding, "Well, to be perfectly accurate, President Obama has promised only not to listen to this chancellor." And I was fairly unapologetic because I thought I was talking to adults. This is what nation states do. And the story I told them, I will tell you. All right. When Kennedy Obama won the election, and this has been mentioned, perhaps not in our session, but I've heard it on recent newscasts, this is a cyber smart president of the United States. I mean, he ran his campaign from his BlackBerry. And we went up to the president-elect after the election, not me personally. He said, "This BlackBerry thing's not a good idea, Mr. President-elect. You really can't. You really can't be doing that BlackBerry thing." And the president responded. He actually said this on CNNBC. It actually sounds almost like a Second Amendment bumper sticker. He actually said on CNBC, "They're going to have to pry it from my fingers." So we said, "Okay, he's probably going to be president since he did carry Ohio, so he's going to keep his BlackBerry." So we then said to him, "Could we borrow it like for 36 hours?" And we did. And, you know, we did some stuff. What's the backstory to that flippant, cartoonish tale, nonetheless true, that I just told you? The backstory is this. We were fully prepared to tell the soon-to-be most powerful man in the most powerful nation on earth that if he used a BlackBerry in his national capital, his texts, his emails, and his phone calls would be subject to intercept by multiple foreign intelligence agencies. That's what adult nations do to one another, and that was the message I had to the Germans. We talked a lot today, and it was really interesting, and Ashley gave some really good comment on this as well, about the whole question of international privacy. I mean, so we're kind of hyperventilating about 215, and what does that mean? But there are other folks who are concerned about what NSA might do to citizens of foreign nations, okay? Truth in lending here, all right? We Americans in the National Security Agency and the National Security Structure, we have historically been Manichaean about the rest of the world. Are you or are you not protected by the Fourth Amendment to the U.S. Constitution? Are you? Oh, my God, we can't touch you. Are you not? Game on. Now, that has run into a legitimate foreign view that privacy should not be the sole province of the citizenship of the nation of which you are a part, but that you as a human being enjoy some measure, some privacy is owed to you simply because of your status as a human being. Now, I will freely admit that's a legitimate principle and it's real fuzzy. Okay? And so we'll see how that evolves going forward and how we Americans will begin to treat that. Now, President Obama launched a group that's going to report out in about 3 weeks about how it is we could extend the kinds of protections we give you to foreigners whose communications have been intercepted and stored by the National Security Agency. When we do that among the Western democracies, that will make one of us. We will be the only one who has ever seriously considered that question. I love the sidebar discussion in the second panel today. Let me put an exclamation point on some of the comments that were made. European parliamentarians know far more about the National Security Agency and GCHQ than they do about their own security services, period. And we need to keep that in mind as we enter these international debates. Okay, that's enough chum in the water. generates questions. You know that talk out there I said I gave at the Grove and the Lakeside thing and all that? I ended up, I don't think I have to do it with you, but I'm going to repeat to you what I said to them. I said, so here's the thing. We're going out for the coin toss. I got Captain Jefferson over here. I got Captain Hamilton over here. All right. I turn to Captain Jefferson. Captain Jefferson, you are indeed the home team. You will call it in the air. My point to the crowd was, game on. Don't be a spectator. Be part of the contest. Thanks, and I'll be happy to take any questions I may or may not have generated.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Our music is performed by Sophia Yan. And as always, please spread the word and promote the Lawfare Podcast via your social networks on Twitter, Facebook, email, and in any way you can. Thanks for listening.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your processes to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart. Schedule package pickups and see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers. With rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up with code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.